Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
You're on.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Readings from the Tribune, Renegade Tribune, of course. I'm going to be reading some selections from the various editions, starting out with talking about the music, because I'm going to be playing it in between. Who's ever out there, however you're feeling, some of us don't like to read anymore because of visual problems or other difficulties. All now you'll have to do is just listen. Wherever you're at, whether you're doing work in the house, outside, just listening to be listening. I'm so glad and so good to be us together while we hear from the wonderful authors that post in the Tribune. And if anyone has any thoughts, please be sure to make a comment and put your insights into them. The first is December 25, posted by Russ Winter of the New Nationalist. It reads, "As a holiday change of pace, the New Nationalist presents the greatest music of 19th century, Romantic Nationalism, two by Czechs and one Russian. The first is a short clip from a Symphony from the New World by Antonín Dvořák. The second is Bedřich Smetana's Vltava, My Country. Third is Tchaikovsky's fabulous 1812 Overture Part 2. Then we finish with the best of a growing body of contemporary romantic nationalism, Protectors of the Earth and Light from Darkness. So I'm going to softly play from the first. And now the first reading was also posted on December 25. In the Tribune. Christmas and the Culture of Whiteness, Part 1 and Part 2. Part 1 disappeared for a moment, please excuse me. There it is, Part 1. Instead, I'm going to start because I just have part two up before me. Please excuse me. This also was put in on Christmas Day by Mike Walsh, our wonderful wordsmith. Christmas Day in the workhouse. Whatever else changes, capitalism never does. Christmas Day in America, 1-7 one out of seven Americans exist miserably on incomes that put them at risk of hunger. Only over 15 million American children rely on food banks for assistance. Food insecurity blights every single U.S. county. More than 31 million American children live on incomes that qualify for subsidized lunches. Nearly 40% of America's homeless are under 18 years of age. Britain lays claim to being one of the world's strongest economies, yet 150,000 young people across England and Wales are homeless, or homelessness is imminent. In Britain, one out of three people have experienced poverty in recent years. In Britain, 3.9 million people are in persistent poverty. Victorian Britain could boast an empire upon which the sun never set. Victorian Britain could also acknowledge, inspiring the monologue, that more than anything else illuminated the need for the collapse of capitalism. It was Christmas Day in the workhouse is a monologue written as a ballad by campaigning journalist George Robert Sims. It was published in the Referee for the Christmas of 1877. It appeared in Sims' regular Mustard and Crest column under the pseudonym Dagenet and was collected in book form in 1881 as one of the Dagenet ballads, which sold over 100,000 copies within a year. It is a criticism of the harsh conditions in English and Welsh workhouses under the 1934 Poor Law as a popular and sentimental melodrama. It is Christmas Day in the workhouse. Now also is the video that the Tribune has posted. What I think I'm going to do, and I'm sure I'll be let known if it's not loud enough, instead of me reading this beautiful, beautiful poem, I'm going to let it play for you. "For Her Bloodless Cheeks Went Crimson." It is old. It's got somewhat of a static, so we're going to give it a try.
Actually, what I should do is I should play that here on my end.
All right,
that will sound a whole lot better.
Okay.
And the chat room is also wondering who it is they're hearing from here tonight. So maybe you can introduce yourself while I get this video pulled up.
All right, and you know I'm plenty ready to read it. But I do love the old reading, so thank you for doing that. Otherwise, I could read it. Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm going to say that I'm Brigitte. I love that name. It has a lot of meaning to me. You can look her up. She's a lot of different spelling. She was a Celtic goddess. I say was. We don't think of her that way much nowadays, do we? But once upon a time, she had a lot of importance to the Celts. And also, it's a beautiful Irish name that many American women also have, Bridget. I am a regular subscriber and have been from as long as I've known about the Tribune. And I was so thrilled when I asked our friend whether I could read from it. And he said, sure, what about Wednesday? That was Monday. So it was hard to be sure what to select.
I've got that audio queued up here, so we can play that. Let me know if you hear it all right.
It's Christmas Day in the workhouse. The cold bare walls are bright with garlands of green and holly. The place is really a pleasant place. For with clean washed hands and faces in a long and hungry line, the paupers sit at the table, for this is the hour they dine. And the guardians and the ladies, although the wind is east, have come in their furs and wrappers to watch their charges feast. Oh, the paupers are meek and lowly with their thank ye kindly mums. So long as they fill their bellies, what matter it whence it comes? But one of the old men mutters, then pushes his plate aside. Great God, he cries, but it chokes me, for this is the day she died. The guardians gazed in horror, and the master's face went white. Did a pauper refuse their pudding? Could their ears have heard aright? But the pauper sat for a moment, then rose with a silence grim, but the others had ceased their chatter and trembled in every limb. And he looked at the guardian's ladies, then eyeing their lords, he said, I'll eat not the food of villains whose hands are foul and red, whose victims cry for vengeance from the dank, unhallowed graves. Oh, he's drunk, said the workhouse master, or else he's mad and raves. Not drunk nor mad, cried the pauper, but only a hunted beast, who, torn by the hounds and mangled, declined your vulture's feast. I don't care a curse for the guardians, and I won't be dragged away. Just let me have the fit out. It's only on Christmas Day that the black past comes to goad me and prey on my burning brain. I'll tell you the rest in a whisper. I swear I won't shout again. Keep your hands off of me. Curse you. Hear me right out to the end. You come to see how paupers the season of Christmas spend. You come to watch us feeding as you watch a captured beast. Hear why a penniless pauper spits on your paltry feast. Last winter, my wife lay dying, starved in a filthy den. I'd never been to your parish. I came to your parish then. I swallowed my pride in coming, for ere the ruin came, I held up my head as a traitor, and I bore a spotless name. I came to your parish craving bread for a starving wife. Bread for a woman who'd loved me through 50 years of life. And what do you think they told me, mocking my awful grief, that the house was open to us, but they wouldn't give out relief. I slunk through the filthy alley. It was a cold, raw Christmas Eve. The baker's shops were open, tempting a man to feed, but I clenched my fists together, and holding my head awry, I came to her empty-handed, and mournfully told her why. Then I told her the house was open. She'd heard of the likes of that, for her bloodless cheeks went crimson, and up in her rags she sat crying, bide the Christmas here, John. We've never had one apart. I think I can stand the hunger. The other would break my heart. All through that eve I watched her, holding her hand in mine, praying to God and weeping, till my lips were salt with brine. I asked her once if she hungered, and as she answered, no, the moon shone in at the window, set in a wreath of snow. And she rose to her feet and trembled, and fell in the rags and moaned, give me a crust, John, I'm famished, for the love of God, she groaned. I rushed from the room like a madman. I flew to the workhouse gate, crying, food, food for a dying woman. And the answer came, too late. Too late! And they drove me away with curses, and I fought with a dog in the street, and I tore from the mongrel's clutches a crust he was trying to eat, back through the filthy by-lanes, back through the dirty slush, up to that crazy garret, wrapped in an awful hush. My heart stood still on the threshold. I paused with a sudden thrill, for there in the silvery moonlight, my Nance lay cold and still. Up to the blackened ceiling, her sunken eyes were cast, and I knew on those lips all bloodless my name had been the last. She had called for her absent husband. Great God, had I but known. She had called in vain, and in anguish she had died in that den alone. Yes, there in a land of plenty lay a loving woman dead, cruelly starved and murdered for one loaf of your parish bread. I came to your gate last Christmas. I crave for a human life. You who would feed us paupers, what of that murdered wife? There, there, get you gone to your dinner. Don't you mind me in the least. Think of the happy paupers eating your Christmas feast. And when you recount their blessings in your smug parochial way, just tell what you did for me, too, only last Christmas Day.
Are you back?
Yes, I am, and that was better than me reading it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The next reading I'm prepared for is Christmas and the Culture of Whiteness. Part one was posted on December 25, and on December 27, Tuesday, part two. If you want to read along with me or just listen, starts out with an excerpt, verse 3 from the Lucia song. The dark shall soon flee from the dells of the earth. So she, a wonderful word to us, speaks. The day shall again, new, made rise from a rosy sky. Saint Lucy, Saint Lucy. Dreaming of a whiteness Christmas. Something that has gained increasing traction is not only academia, but also in popular culture, is the idea that people of European descent, i.e. white people, have no real culture of their own. This idea has largely come out of whiteness studies, which is an offshoot of neo-Marxist critical theory, and has entrenched itself into the worldview of an increasing number of people across the Western world. If you ask any adherent to this philosophy, what number of people, what white culture is, they might respond with words like patriarchy, capitalism, oppression, privilege, cultural appropriation, racism, exploitation, etc. They might even say that white people don't really have a culture of their own outside the Big Macs and Hollywood movies. There is perhaps no better, more consolidated example to support this view than the modern Christmas or holiday season. Christmas and the holiday season have become synonymous with capitalism, commercialism, consumerism, materialism, and of course, racism. The myth of the fat old white man going around the world spreading cheer by distributing all the latest consumer products the white global consumerist market has to offer. This is what Christmas or the holidays are all about in modern consumer society. Plus, add to that the annual resurgence of all the various debates around whether we say Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays or what skin color Santa and Jesus should have. One could even argue that the origins of Christmas, i.e. the Jewish Jesus Nativity story, is a sort of white culture appropriation, as it is a story involving Middle Eastern people and Middle Eastern lands that is claimed by many white folk as their own. In the following series, and by the way, this is written by Lightning Warrior, what I'm going to lay out here is the case that what has become known as the oppressive non-culture of whiteness, particularly as exemplified by the modern holiday mythos, is in fact something that was slowly imposed on white people, who in fact do have a rich cultural tradition that still lives on despite multiple attempts to twist, subvert, and eradicate it over the centuries. I also plan to show how this rich culture which has been shared with the world in a variety of forms, is also personified by the stories and traditions surrounding what has become known as Christmas. And this culture lives on in us in a deep, archetypal, and spiritual way, and is available to us here and now. Jolly old Saint Odin. I have written in the past about the solar myth that forms the spiritual significance of this time of year, and the deeper mysteries and parallels of Christianity, and the earlier Proto-Indo-European religions. However, what of the Santa myth that rivals Jesus in significance during this time of year? What of this seemingly archetype of modern white patriarchal consumerist globalization? When it comes to the origins of the figure known as Santa Claus, a lot of people immediately gravitate toward the story of Saint Nicholas of Myra. A somewhat legendary figure, Saint Nicholas was reputed to have a legendary habit of secret gift-giving. Nicholas was said to be a Greek Christian in the Byzantine Empire and lived in the 4th century AD, 3 to 4 centuries before the Muslim conquest of the region. However, some have argued that Nicholas was in fact born of wealthy ethnic black Anatolian Moors. However, the origins of what became Santa Claus are in truth much older than that, and originated in a much colder place. In many parts of pre-Christian northern and central Europe, the winter solstice was known as the time when Odin, or Wotan, the white-bearded ruler of Asgard, led his hunting party across the sky. Known as the Wild Hunt, Odin rode his 8-legged steed named Sleipnir, which would leap great distances across the heavens. During this time, children would leave their boots by the chimney filled with carrots and hay to feed Sleipnir. In return for their charity, Odin would leave the children gifts by their boots. Now, this night of Odin's wild hunt has a counterpart in what is known as Lucinata, or the Lucy Night in Sweden. This is now celebrated as St. Lucy's Day and occurs on the 13th of December every year. However, before the Gregorian calendar shift, it would have fallen on December 21, the night of the winter solstice. Some legends suggest that a supernatural female entity was said to ride through the air with her fearsome followers called Luciferda, and that it was particularly dangerous to be out on this night. Misbehaved children had to take special care, as Lucy could come down the chimney and take them away. And if certain tasks needed to prepare for Yule were not completed, Lucy would punish the household. The contrast between Odin, who left gifts, and Lucy, who brought punishment, has echoes of the lighter part of St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, and the Krampus. Interestingly, some scholars link Krampus as a member of the fearsome entourage of the ancient Germanic goddess Frau Pushta, who some connect with the ancient Norse goddess Freya, one of the primary Vanir or old culture gods who someday ruled before the Aesir. The inclusion of both the fearsome and the festive shows a deep understanding of the dualism inherent in nature that these ancient European peoples possessed, especially during this most perilous time of year. On the one hand, we have the often harsh and brutal forces of nature during the cold winter months. And on the other, we have the festive joy that comes from the promise of the return of the sun. But if we go even deeper and look at etymology and linguistics, we add another layer of sophistication. Swedish stems from the Indo-European family of languages, if we round out the name of Lucy, and in particular her Luciferda, the name Lucifer might perhaps come to mind. Lucifer, of course, stems from Luxfari, which is another Indo-European language, and that is Latin, literally means light-bringing. We perhaps see that these ancient Northern Europeans were pointing at how it was the oft-times terrifying darkness that carried the light that brought life to the world. This is true not only within nature, but within the trials and tribulations of our own lives and our own being. The night is darkest before the dawn. We see this deep understanding mirrored in the Scandinavian festival of St. Lucy, where traditionally a procession is led by a beautiful young lady adorned with a crown or wreath of candles upon her head. Although now this is being changed to be more politically correct, bringing the promise of life-giving light into the darkest night. The cold and brutal Northern European winter was a time that had the potential to bring starvation and death, and often did. But with after the passing of the solstice, the people knew that the days were slowly beginning to grow longer and the life-giving sun was growing stronger. The Norse Germanic festival of Yule was celebrated for right around the time of the winter solstice, all the way through the second week in January. This festival of feasting, drinking, and sacrifice was a hallowed tradition among pre-Christian Northern European peoples, to whom winter had a special significance that was not held among others. Yule was the tradition of a people who were close to the land and intimately tied
your life for this country when you were young. Never questioned orders that they gave, 'cause the love of the red and white and blue was in your heart. And I never thought I'd ever see the day when I'd hear you say, hey, now look at the Sixth Society, look back in time. Now look at the Sixth Society, we commit a crime.
Over 1,200 rabbis. Can you imagine getting 1,200 rabbis to agree on one thing? But agree they did, and what they agreed was to ask our elected officials not to halt or even to limit the United States Refugee Admissions Program. And it's not just Hayek's. Jewish organizations of all kinds across the spectrum of Judaism are issuing statements in support of refugees. These have included the Orthodox Union, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and so many of the Jewish organizations that you heard are co-sponsors of this event.
As fortune fades. grave.
Thank you. I'm going to continue. These ancient white people were a very distinct culture with rich customs and traditions. However, they would eventually find their culture usurped and altered at the point of a sword by invaders from the south and the east, as well as traitors within their own tribe. Of course, what I am referring to is the spread of Christianity in Europe. Christianity moved in slowly at first, with the rather tolerant Northern European pagans accepting, and in some cases even adopting, the worship of this new god, seeing similarities between their deities of similar attributes. This was commonplace during the odd phase of the Roman Empire, where Celtic gods and Roman gods were often mixed and matched. However, Rome began to use its wealth and influence to spread its influence, bribing local rulers and nobility, who in turn would use their military resources to impose the new religion on their people as well as neighboring tribes. Another reason this new empire was so successful was that it also became adept at using more subtle tactics, such as co-opting the patron deities of various European peoples and turning them into Christian saints. These figures would be attributed to various good deeds or miracles that made them similar to the deity the church wished to replace. They would then proclaim the pagan festivals and holy days that used to belong to the old deity as now being a celebration and veneration of that saint. This is more than likely what happened with figures like St. Nicholas and St. Lucy in Northern Europe. By the end of the 14th century, the entirety of Europe had been converted to Christianity. And even after the split between the Eastern and Western Church in 1054 AD, Rome would still control Europe and its people from the British Isles to Scandinavia, all the way into Hungary and parts of Romania. Through the church, Rome controlled the people, not only through political means, but through the indoctrination of the people into a dogmatic belief system, if by proxy controlled their minds. The conflict of the incoming Semitic Saturnian religion with that of the Indo-European solar religion has in many respects seemed to create a sort of neuroses in the European collective consciousness. This could be in part because this was not really an organic spirituality of the people based on their unique relationship to nature and spirit, but rather something that was foisted upon them, largely against their will. This could also be because the totality of what was happening and is continuing to happen with these archetypal forces has not been fully understood and integrated. Thank you. I'll go on to part two, Christmas and the Culture of Whiteness. Once again, by Lightning Warrior. Starts out with the quote, "And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. From the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2, verses 10 to 14. Putting the Christ in Christmas. In his prose, The Jewish Question in the Spiritual World, 20th century Italian mystic and philosopher Giulio Savola wrote, "The term Semitic, as everyone knows, has a broader connotation than the word Jewish. The Jewish element cannot be clearly separated from the general type of civilization that in ancient times spread throughout the Eastern Mediterranean from Asia Minor to the edges of Arabia. The ideals of the Northern European peoples, especially in their relationships with the land and nature and the egalitarian relationships between men and women, were very different from the Roman Semitic cultures who formed the foundation of the Christian religion as we know it. These cultures were largely based in brutal patriarchal dominance and the idea that nature was something to be subdued and utilized. Ironically, it is the latter culture that has become synonymous with whiteness and the cultural institutions of white Europeans. Indeed, what we will see is that this cultural label is something that was imposed upon Northern, Western Europeans by a hostile Roman Semitic cultural empire. As Evola expressed, quote, what characterizes the spirituality of Semitic civilizations in general? The destruction of the Aryan synthesis of virility and spirituality? Among the Semites, we have, on one hand, a crudely material and sensualistic, a coarsely and ferociously warlike Assyria, expression of the virile principle. On the other, a devirilized spirituality, a lunar and predominantly priestly relationship to the divine, the pathos of guilt and atonement, an impure and disordered romanticism, and beside it, almost as an escape, a naturalistic and mathematically based contemplativism. Now, while there are many aspects that make up a culture, and many of them are arguably superficial, is the archetypal myths and spirituality that truly define them. The spirituality that came out of the Semitic world is primarily understood by those versed in deep astrology and esoteric studies to be a collection, Saturnian, Jovian, and lunar cults, something I addressed in my article, The Abrahamic Question. The people of the arid deserts of the Middle East had a particular veneration for the gods of the night sky and would have undoubtedly had a different perception and relationship with the sun than did the people of the cold northern climates. Among the gods of the night sky, Saturn had a special place in the Semitic mysteries. The Roman senator and historian Tacitus declared that the Jews considered this planet to have the most powerful influence on human life. In Hebrew, Saturn is named Shabbateh, and the Jewish Shabbat is on Saturday, or Saturn's day. Saturn is understood as the god of linear time and matter. Saturn, or Cronus in Greek myth, is also known for being jealous and violent, a trait ascribed to the god of the Old Testament. Saturn was the god that ate his own children for fear they would usurp him. Saturn is the god who accepts the sacrifice of children, be it their whole bodies or just a piece of their genitals, for example, infant circumcision. He is El, which some may recognize as from biblical Elohim in the Old Testament. The Romans also shared this veneration for Saturn and even had an ancient festival called Saturnalia on what would have equated to the 23rd of December on the modern Gregorian festival calendar. Festival was remarkably similar in nature to the ancient Semitic festivals of the goddess Inanna Ishtar, marked by continual partying, a carnival-like atmosphere that overturned the social norms. It is understood in many esoteric and occult circles that the sphere Saturn stands in opposition to the sun disk. Saturn is understood to represent linear time, law and restrictions, matter and death, while the sun is understood to represent the life, growth, and the eternal and boundless spirit that never dies. Saturn has always represented the age that has passed, while the sun rises to new life eternal. This opposition is mirrored in the figures of Christ and Satan, who are in turn reflections of the Zoroastrian, Indo-Iranian Aryan religion, Ahura Mazda, and Ahriman. Looking at things this way, we can perhaps appreciate a deeper significance in what became the Bible. During the time of the Roman Empire, it is no secret that there were sects of Jews that were essentially bought off by the Roman Empire. There were, of course, the Pharisees and Sadducees, as well as the various houses of nobility and wealthy Jewish merchant and banking elites. Later on, there was even intermarriage between some aristocratic Roman and Jewish Semitic families, something that is not uncommon among elite families of different kingdoms for political purposes, among others. However, many Jews at that time were becoming increasingly upset with not only the foreign occupancy, but the corruption of their own civic as well as religious leaders. This led to a series of revolts and rebellions in Roman-occupied Judea, all of which were crushed by the Roman Empire. However, by the reign of Roman Emperor Constantine the Great in the 4th century AD, the Roman Empire, the largest empire the world had ever seen, had fallen into a cycle of decadence and decay. Rome was splintering and having the issues that large empires attempting to hold on to vast areas of land while incorporating large, diverse populations do. But Constantine had the foresight of taking Christianity, which at that time was a diverse collective of underground mystery cults and Judaic reform zealot movements scattered throughout the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern world, and officially adopting it as the new state religion. Constantine called the First Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, which made official which of the beliefs of the various Christian sects would be incorporated and which would be deemed heretical, and established the Roman Catholic, known as Universal Church. What became Roman Christianity was then fashioned into a political and ideological weapon. While some say that Rome fell in 455 AD after the sack of Rome, the truth is, Rome didn't fall. It simply changed its face. It would be through the Vatican and the enormous wealth and political power that it wielded that the empire known as Rome would live on and continue to impose its will upon the rest of Europe. But fortunately, even this officially sanctioned state religion of the Saturnian Empire struggling to maintain power could not ignore the undeniable solar mythos that thrived not only in Northern Europe but in the Mediterranean European world as well. From an esoteric perspective, it could be said that much of human history as we know it has been a back and forth struggle between the solar impulse and the Saturnian and the peoples that personified and embodied them in mind, heart, and deed. In addition to the cult of Saturn, there was another cult that operated in Rome right up until the time of the establishment of the church And that was the cult of Sol Invictus, unconquered Suri. This unconquered sun, this cult was particularly popular among the reputably brave and disciplined Roman soldiers to whom Sol Invictus was their patron deity. There are some scholars who also will argue that the day of Christmas, December 25th, chosen officially for Christmas, also coincides with its holy day of Dies Natalis Solis Invicti, birthday of the unconquered sun. It is worth noting that references to this cult seem to disappear right around the same time Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. Of course, any casual study of Roman Christian symbolism will see that it is absolutely saturated with solar references. In the ancient Greco-Roman world, Jewish travelers and merchants who lived in the cosmopolitan cities like Athens and the Greco-Egyptian metropolis of Alexandria came in contact with Neoplatonic philosophy and its concept of the logos, or word, the primal force of creation. Many Hellenized Jews adopted these new ideas and infused them with their own beliefs, something that the nomadic Jews commonly did throughout their history. One of the most famous of these Hellenized Jewish philosophers was Philo of Alexandria. These Gnostics took a great deal of their ideas from the Greek world, which in many respects was largely influenced by the Persian Aryan, this is what forms the root of Iranian Empire, and its Zoroastrian religion. The Persians were, of course, Indo-Iranians, are understood to be ethnic racial cousins of the Indo-Europeans, who included the Celtic and Norse Germanic tribes. The Gnostic sects were known for a rejection of the Old Testament God as being an impostor, a blind, arrogant demiurge who only created matter, but not the totality of the spiritual universe. They were also known for the worship of the mother goddess Sophia and her consort, the Christ. Historically, Gnosticism could be understood as a reaction to the artifice and disconnection from that cosmopolitan life in ancient cities like Alexandria created. These Gnostics were later deemed heretics and hunted down and persecuted by the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Church could not ignore the solar mythos that saturated Europe and was part of its Indo-Aryan folk heritage, so it did the next best thing. It co-opted it. It is perhaps that the forces behind the empire sought not only to use this new religion to reestablish its political control on the people of Europe and the Middle East, but also attempt to subvert and stamp out the true light that was coming through the various philosophies that became known as Gnosticism. At their heart, these Gnostic practices were aimed at empowering the individual to tap into the force of Sol Invictus within themselves and discover that, as Jesus said, the kingdom of heaven is within. If we look at the deep esoteric interpretation of the Nativity story on a macro level, it's a story describing how the Christ light, the light of the eternal sun, miraculously emerges out of the womb of the Great Mother, which is the void of darkness from which the light of creation emerges. The sun in the sky is a supreme physical manifestation of that light. However, this story is just as potent as it relates allegorically to the individual. We see that cave where the Savior is born, has been known by many, adapts to be the human skull. Mary and Joseph within us are known to represent the pituitary and pineal glands within the brain, as well as the feminine receptive and masculine active portions of consciousness. When these are brought into harmony through deep meditation, the two appear to create an area of reflective light, which can almost seem to be akin to light bouncing off two mirrors. This creates the manger, within where the child of light is born in the solar plexus. When the child is born, the animals in the manger, our animal natures, are tame and brought to peace. Both the humble shepherds and the wise magi bow down before the light of the eternal, internal sun. Looking at this narrative, we might perhaps see a degenerated, elite class that pays lip service to the spirit of the sun, but seeking to hold on to their finite power, they keep the religion of Saturn in their fearful hearts. Like King Herod in the Nativity story, they are perhaps in terror of their own inevitable obsolescence. They have turned to a religion of the old decaying father that tries to devour the new rising S-U-N-S-O-N. Sun, in contrast, we see the spirituality of the virile capital S sun that is unconquerable and rises through the strong and honorable who have the within them the infinite life and love of the eternal light of creation. This is a spirituality that has undeniably been best embodied in the cultures and consciousness of the Indo-Iranian, Aryan European peoples, which have been a much maligned gift to the world. Thank you. That is the ending of that. Now, keeping to the Christmas spirit and getting to Mike Walsh. This was posted on December 27. Getting to our times, the title is Can't Make Ends Meet. It reads, careful with your finances. Pay your credit cards on time to avoid interest charges. Don't be too smug. Reflect every time you purchase a train ticket, buy a pair of shoes, or call an ambulance. Roughly 40% of the cost will go directly to your bank's e-vaults. According to Alan Brown, attorney and chairman of the Public Banking Institute, bank interest charges are of a regressive nature. This means the poor, without their being aware of it, are constantly milked to saturate the rich. If the nation enjoyed a public rather than a corporate bank, the population would benefit by 40% on everything bought or service used. In the 2012 edition of Occupy Money, released in November, German professor Margrethe Kennedy revealed that 35 to 40% of everything we purchase goes on private bank interest. This unearned income is bled by bankers, financiers, and bondholders. Every time buyers spend £100, €100, or US dollars, 40% of the purchase price is vacuumed up in interest and bank charges by the banks that do not produce anything. Right along the chain of supply, from wherever in the world it is sourced, Those involved in getting the raw materials to retail standards are dependent upon bank credit. Without bank credit and charges, they cannot produce products or services that we depend on. Every farmer, manufacturer, wholesaler, or service supplier in this vital chain must pay for investment, taxes, stock, premises, labor, materials, shipping, and transport, etc., etc. This is usually funded by bank loans, charges, overdrafts, and banking fees. This money is then added to the price of our goods by banks before we find their service on the shop shelves or at the end of the telephone order. This number crunching credit is a cumulative and variable. Dr. Kennedy, who researched this spider's web of deceit, discovered that even in fiscally prudent Germany, bank interest adds 12% to the cost of refuse collection. When we receive our water bills, presume an eye-watering 38% of the invoice value will go directly to the e-vaults of the private banking sector. What about public housing? In judicious Germany, a breathtaking 77% of rentable public housing is absorbed by private bank interest charges and fees. Can you still hear me? I'm wondering if... Good. Thank you, dear. I wanted to be sure. If you are an American, hesitate before you breathe a sigh of relief. Compound interest on most mortgages amounts to 80% of what you pay for your home or business premises. 80%. America is the home of the free ride if you are a bondholder, banker, or financier. The noted German researcher and analyst draws heavily on the findings of economist Helmut Frick.
One side of World War II. They don't want us to know the real history of what happened over 70 years ago, seeing through the eyes of the German victims. The horror of the terror bombing, the mass rape of millions of women and children, the torture and murder of civilians, the death camps for surrendered soldiers, the ethnic cleansing of whole countries, and the planned extermination of the entirety of the German people. After watching Hellstorm, you'll never see the good war and the good guys in the same light ever again. Watch for free and get DVDs at hellstormdocumentary.com.
War on error. We have declared war on error.
You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Thank you. Continued on with the article, and of course, if you look at the printed article, you'll see the wonderful illustrations that have been included. The noted German researcher and analyst draws heavily on the findings of economist Helmut Kurz. As we might expect, the researcher's findings are based on the German economic model. If you are not a German, don't get too excited. The same system is in place throughout the European Union, United Kingdom, and US. In the case of the latter financial sector, profits comprise an incredible 40% of the price of all American purchases. This may go some way to explaining why only 1% of Americans own 42% of the national wealth. Only 5% of this wealth is shared between a community comprising 80% of the population. As Ellen Brown points out, the implications are stunning. If we had a financial system that transferred private bank interest back to the public purse, 35% could be lopped off the price of everything we buy. That means we could buy 3 items for the price of 2. Our salaries would go 50% farther than they go today. Is there an answer? Many nations introduced a fairer public banking system, the most notable being National Socialist Germany. By dismissing the private banking system foisted upon it, Hitler's Germany in just 36 months catapulted from being one of Europe's poorest countries to the world's richest. Libya's president Muammar Gaddafi introduced the African dinar to compete with the euro and the US dollar. We know what happened to his authority and those of other maverick nations. There will be change simply because Western capitalism cannot continue to be based on a system so corruptly in favor of international banking conglomerates. This archaic and desperately unfair system will be replaced by a public-owned banking system. It is because competing trading nations have already shown Rothschild the door that leaves Western capitalism no choice in the matter. It is war or peace. Thank you. Getting up to date, too, with some of our latest problems here in America. Just posted today is the article on holiday black mob violence across U.S. Be very alert and protect yourself. I imagine most of us who are reading here already know this. I'll go ahead and just in case you're not aware, be aware. It reads, over the holiday weekend, a series of fisticuff and hooliganism incidents broke out in malls around the United States. Unfortunately, the fake mainstream news media won't provide profiles and information on who is behind or involved with such mob violence. Instead, the following examples of information are parlayed to the public. All people need to realize that you can't get factual news from fake news sources about these criminal elements. Profiling the instigators as teens is not in the interest of public safety. By default, once again, it falls on the fake news not to mince words. The New Nationalist views it as a necessity to examine it, making the task quite easy. The fact that many of these mob incidents are filmed and put on YouTube. TNN, which stands for the New Nationalist, from which this article was taken, examined about a dozen of these clips from over the weekend, and the evidence is overwhelming that these are 100% black youth mobs. We could only spot other races in a defensive posture. The ages of the perpetrators appear to be between 10 and 20 years old. A group of young blacks enter the Sears on 60th Street in Upper Darby. Police say about 40 members of Flash Mob from Philadelphia stole thousands of dollars of merchandise in minutes. And there's a picture of this. Going on. For your safety, and as a reference point, you will rarely see older black males involved with this. But if you are in a public mall, be very aware that black teenage females are in the thick of it, and in fact, are often instigating these brouhahas and egging on the didn't-do-nothing black males. In the course of these events, people of all races and ages are terrorized. In the following video, you can see a very diverse group of people hiding out together in a mall store, and it shows. Going on. Special treatment is meted out to Asians, who tend to be smaller stature, and also to smaller white kids. TNN was hard-pressed to spot a 6'3", 210-pound fighting-age white male being messed with. If you are smaller, young, and of any race, be on guard with these cowards. Asians are primarily being targeted by dindus in schools. Especially listen to the SJW school administrator, who looks like the infamous Noah Nautiv's cousin, diminishing this by referring to gang bullying as just kids getting into fights, like it was some schoolyard in Kansas in the early 1950s. And it gives a video of that. There is also a form of almost fake fighting going on among blacks that looks somewhat choreographed. But interspersed and almost blended in, you will see videos of young white kids being gang assaulted and whopped on, so to speak. This can unfold rapidly as Dindu thugs are quick and agile as well as sneaky. The risk is going down, at which point you can be severely kicked or stomped. See the self-defense video at the end of this article. Another form of, quote, New America, end quote, sneak attack, criminal black hostility that few are aware of is drug-related and involves offering laced marijuana or other recreational drugs. Case in point, my own son admitted to me that he was offered weed by several friendly Hindus in Washington, D.C. Personally, I believe he was naively sucked in by the sense of community and party atmosphere while under the influence of alcohol during a summer outdoor festival and purchased it. Regardless, in a Beavis and Butthead moment, he was foolish enough to partake. Some hours later, he ended up in the middle of the night in a ghetto area, nearly comatose, and had to be rescued by his girlfriend using a GPS locator. He guessed the pot was laced with crack, but who knows? A similar incident happened to a friend of his at a concert. So, the lesson learned. Do not naively trust or even be nice. Profile, and just stay away from such people. This is about self-preservation and protection. Once again, New America. There is another form of black violence that involves assaults on older, vulnerable people. This is sometimes referred to as the knockout game. Although examples are continuously censored, there is still a shocking collection of such videos plastered on the internet and on YouTube. The following viral video comes from Tommy Sotomayor, a black man who reads these thugs the riot act. Well done. As is his advice to white people who should be alert and at the ready. As mentioned, older black folks, and especially Asians, are also targeted and should be alert. And that video is also posted. Now, when you watch these assaults, you will see these are rarely mano-a-mano types of fights. Instead, they are deliberately mismatches of young black men with fighting skills against older victims, smaller people, or women. If a stronger individual is marked, they use gangs. As seen in the previous video, the modus operandi are sucker punches and sneak attacks. And it gives self-defense instructions in the next video. So, there we are with what's going on right now today. Everywhere in America, I hate to say. No, but I have the music to play. Play you to listen to while I pull up the next one. It is on, there's an article about the folk dancing. I had that one pulled up, but I've still got the romantic modern music. Thank you. All right, here's another article that is right where we needed to be. Today it was posted about MIT scientist explains why modern wheat is causing so many health problems. Written by Anna Hunt of Waking Times. The use of Monsanto's Roundup herbicide has increased substantially over the last 40 years. Many researchers are starting to believe that increased use of glyphosate, active ingredient in Roundup, correlates to the rise in many modern diseases. According to Dr. Stephanie Seneff, a senior research scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, glyphosate appears to be strongly correlated with the rise in celiac disease and more generally gluten intolerance. There's a quote here by Dr. Anthony Samso and Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Gluten dysplasias brought on by exposure to glyphosate plays a crucial role in developing a silly disease. Many CYP enzymes are impaired in association with celiac disease. And we show that glyphosate's known suppression of CYP enzyme activity in plants and animals plausibly explains this effect in humans. There's a rise in glyphosate use in the United States. According to the report published in Environmental Sciences Europe titled Trends in Glyphosate Herbicide Use in the United States and Globally by Charles M. Benbrook, there has been a dramatic increase in the amount of glyphosate sprayed on crops since the mid-1990s, the report states. Since 1974 in the U.S., over 1.6 billion kilograms of glyphosate active ingredient have been applied, or 19% of estimated global use of glyphosate, 8.6 billion kilograms. Globally, glyphosate use has risen almost 15-fold since so-called Roundup Ready genetically engineered glyphosate tolerant crops were introduced in 1996. Two-thirds of the total volume of glyphosate applied in the U.S. from 1974 to 2014 has been sprayed in just the last 10 years. The corresponding share globally is 72%. In 2014, farmers sprayed enough glyphosate to apply on every hectare of U.S. cultivated cropland and nearly 0.47 pounds acre on all cropland worldwide. Use of glyphosate on non-GMO wheat crop. Glyphosate via the product Roundup is known to be commonly sprayed on GMO corn, GMO soybean, GMO cotton crops. But what many people may not realize is that glyphosate herbicide is also commonly used on non-GMO wheat crop. The practice is so common that wheat has become the third most common crop to be sprayed with glyphosate. In 1990, wheat crop in the U.S. was sprayed with over 497,000 pounds of glyphosate. In 2014, this increased 35-fold to over 17.7 million pounds sprayed just in that 1 year. In comparison, GMO crops such as corn and soybean were sprayed with over 69.9 million pounds and 122.5 million pounds of glyphosate, respectively, in 2014. The amount used on cotton crops was similar to wheat at 17.4 million pounds. These statistics were reported by the National Agriculture Statistical Service, which is part of the United States Department of Agriculture. The NAS also conducted the 2012 Agricultural Chemical Use Survey among wheat producers in 15 U.S. states, and the Republic report is published right there by the Tribune. Now, in this report, the NAS revealed that 61% of winter wheat, 99% of durum, and 97% of other spring wheat were treated with herbicides. Glyphosate use was mostly reported by durum wheat farmers. Desiccation in wheat. One would wonder why wheat is sprayed with glyphosate, even though wheat is not a GMO project. Crop, this was the exact question asked by Dr. Stephanie Seneff as she researched the connection between the rise in celiac disease and the use of glyphosate. Through her research, Dr. Seneff found that wheat farmers are using glyphosate on their crop just before wheat harvest for two reasons. First, they're desiccating organic wheat crops, so they kill off the wheat after harvest so there is less to clear. Second, When you expose wheat to a toxic chemical such as glyphosate, it releases more seed as it dies. As a result, farmers get higher yield. As a result, glyphosate can be found in one of the most common ingredients of the modern Western diet, wheat. Is this practice of desiccating the wheat crop mean the decimation of the gut? Dr. Sinnott believes so, quoting her, "I just do not understand how the U.S. government refuses to acknowledge that we're basically slowly poisoning and killing our population." There you have it, folks. Thank you so much. Play some more music while I pull up another article. I'd like to read from our own Kyle. He doesn't like, or of course, Mike Walsh. I got so inspired to read these words aloud by reading one of Mike's tributes. He does write beautiful tributes. Instead, I think it's easier for me right now to pull up the article that he wrote about. It just came today. Some of you may be able to find it if you want to read along with it. Male is a four-letter word. And the picture is so disturbing that Kyle put in of a young man sitting on a park bench, his head down, his hands over his head. It reads, "Male is a four-letter word. Spiraling crime and antisocial behavior is conclusively linked to dysfunctional family lifestyles in which the father is absent. Is the downgrading of men linked to family breakdown? In recent decades, society has gone through change more radical than political revolution. Traditional fathers were respected heads of household and main providers. There were instances in which this responsibility was abused, but overall, the family unit worked well. Growing boys today are much less involved with mature males. Boys' interest groups have disappeared, and male teachers are notable by their absence. Young men reach maturity unsure as to their gender role as they emerge from a largely female chrysalis. Some have never known a father. Young men were once guided by alpha males in manly values, honor, education, martial valor, worldview experience, sport, the arts and sciences. They aspired to political leadership. They carried with it duty and responsibility. Who do boys have to inspire them these days? Overpaid prima donna sportsmen and overrated television celebrities. Boys were once taught to respect the fairer sex. The latter responded by displaying feminine traits. It is increasingly difficult to separate the sexes by appearance, mannerisms, or interest. Until recently, a boy reached maturity having been mentored by a father who instilled male virtues. This would be complemented by a boy being educated by male teachers, instilled in callow youth with self-discipline. Fairness in sports, how to endure hardship. Boys would be encouraged to show respect for others and the importance of self-respect, self-worth. Youngsters would be inspired to achieve according to their ability. As lads matured, they were given masculine examples from which they might draw inspiration and wisdom. There were strong elements of duty and self-worth. Personal responsibility was valued. To pass the buck would be considered unmanly. But unmanliness is now a life choice. Where are those who should be setting good examples? Politicians come to mind. Their abysmal standards of personal behavior are equally contemptible and disreputable as those of any footloose father traipsing from one sink estate to another. What has taken the place of earlier generations once inspired by explorers, sportsmen, entertainers who could actually play a musical instrument? True heroes were explorers, servicemen, civil engineers, underpaid sportsmen, authors, cultural achievers, and aggressively successful entrepreneurs. By the 1960s, the fabric of society structure was stretched to its limits. Values and tradition were questioned. It became de rigueur to rebel, to mock standards, deny authority, challenge tradition, and amuse oneself with incivility and the profane, to question and push moral boundaries. Today, the traditional role of husband and father is constantly undermined. The once head of household has become a derisory figure rather than a fulcrum of respect. Television sitcoms depict father as hapless, immoral, or an apron-feminized fusspot. Today's male is ridiculed in ways that
until 4 in the morning, photoshopping Donald Trump's head onto scenes from movies to share with your fellow shitlords? Do you actually believe that the Jews don't run nothing?
The Jews don't run nothing.
Do you say things like this?
There's no stopping us. We're taking that Jewish puppet master and we're saying, look, bitch, we're making this puppet do what we want.
Or this?
They are building the wall by March.
Well, we can help. The Renegade 12-Step Program for Trumpaholics is a tried-and-true method for bitch-slapping you back into reality.
No, I'm with Israel 100%.
The first step is admitting you have a problem. The rest is all downhill from here.
All right, going on, thank you. Is it okay? I will go on. Elderly men. Elderly men once reminisced about old comradeships, male bonding, and masculine pursuits. There were gender-specific trades, shared experiences with lifelong friendships forged. What will the young men of today muse over when they are old? When those concerned saw the dangers, they were satirized mercilessly. In matrimonial or child custody courts, men have become superfluous to requirements. then have become the outcast of society. If men become feckless and much less masculine than they once were, if men avoid commitment of any kind, was it their choice to become so, or were they made so by changing conventions? Thank you. I'd like now to read from our very own Kyle Hunt, and that was posted on November 16, the National Socialist War Against Modern Art. And if you hadn't read it, do go to it, because the pictures are worth the trip, I'm telling you. I read from him. Wouldn't it be great to purge our society of all the degenerate modern art that is relentlessly shoved down our throats? It is poorly executed, does not require any talent, degrades the human spirit, is thoroughly Jewish, and makes sane people feel physically sick. Well, the National Socialists, led by a talented painter named Adolf Hitler, saw this art as a threat to the well-being of the German folk and decided to do something about it. They called it Entartete Kunst, which is German for degenerate art. And quarantine pieces that they deemed to be subversive, putting them on display for the folk to see in its proper context, while the German people lined up by the thousands to view the degenerate art exhibit and laugh at the grotesque creations Jews have been passing off as something valuable during the Weimar Republic. Compared with the artwork being promoted by the National Socialists, the degenerate art looked like the work of mentally ill children with finger paints. And he shows examples and has a video of those. The Jewish media loves to kvetch over all the priceless treasures that were taken by the Nazis, but never will you hear them mention all of the amazing artwork, including the architecture that went up in a fiery blaze in Dresden, along with hundreds of thousands of tortured souls, thanks to the murderous hatred of the Allies. In 2014, there was an Entartete Kunst exhibit in New York City that actually showed the sanctioned art as the banned art. During Adolf Hitler's, quote, rise to power in the 1930s, one of the many groups he targeted during his quest to remake the world in his image was modern artists. The Nazis confiscated works by Matisse, Van Gogh, Picasso, and others, and at a historic art show in 1937, displayed modern art pieces as degenerate art. Aaron Moriarty of 48 Hours takes us on a tour of the recreated event at the Neue Gallery in New York City. And Kyle has a video of that, which is also on YouTube. I'll read on. It's somewhat humorous, though, at the same time, tragically, terribly tragic, to watch as these so-called experts try to make the degenerate art seem intellectual and important, while denigrating the classical European masterpieces. I would venture to say that even some people who have been thoroughly indoctrinated into the Jewish system walked through the gallery and felt more drawn to the work of the, in quotes, evil Nazis, in quotes. Real beauty, excellence, and artistry is reviled by our Jewish rulers because it inspires us to greatness, and also because they can never achieve such glorious heights. They want to infect us with their own degeneracy and debase the spirit of our folk so that we are more easily ruled. They want us all stuck in the mud and not reaching for the stars. Thank you. Now I'm going to go to the diversity of European folk dancers, and I wanted to play some of it. It was just posted this week also. It has a beautiful picture of European women. It's written, just says, Renegades, mainly videos. We are told time and again by the anti-white academics that Europeans do not have culture, but this could not be further from the truth. And I'll let you play that if you want. I'm going to pull up now Russian Realism, paintings by Ilya Repin. It's a beautiful painting. I, of course, so attracted to the 19th century paintings and art. Pull this over if you want to pull it up. You can see it. Russian Realism paintings by Ilya Repin. Ilya Repin, 1844 to 1930, was a Russian realist painter who rejected the colorful and free impressionism that was becoming popular in the art world and instead focused on the life of the Russian peasant while still doing portraits of the Russian elite. He was living in Finland at the time of the October Revolution. And by the way, this was posted on August 31, if you want to pull it up. And he declined an offer to return to Russia, remaining in independent Finland until his death. Nevertheless, his paintings were held up as an ideal of realism in the Soviet Union. Note the felled trees in the background of Religious Procession. Rapin wrote, "The exploiters of the region cut down my favorite forest where I have had so many childhood memories." And then it goes on to show many of the beautiful paintings. You can just look at them for hours. All you have to do is go to the Tribune to see these paintings in one spot. Pull it down. All right. Thank you. And now I would like to read Elizabeth Schwarzkopf, the Unrepented National Socialist. This was posted in October by Mike Walsh, our wordsmith. And sorry if I don't get all the proper names pronounced the way they want them pronounced. Elizabeth Schwarzkopf was to opera singing what fellow National Socialist Herbert von Karajan was to orchestral conducting. Nothing short of perfection and adherence to originality would suit her temperament and this extraordinary singer's voice. Born December 9, 1915, the beautiful Prussian might easily have been lured by the medical profession. Happily for the world of music lovers, she took up a career in classical singing. Elizabeth was 18 years old when in 1933 Adolf Hitler's chancellorship was endorsed by the German electorate. There were heady times for a Germany that was to soon afterwards disentangle itself from the coils of the Versailles Treaty and international banking elite. This was a pivotal moment in Europe's fortunes. David Lloyd George, former Prime Minister, British, was impressed. Upon his return, following a visit to Hitler, his daughter greeted Lloyd George humorously with, "Heil Hitler." "Yes," he replied, "Heil Hitler. I too say that because he is truly a great man. I have never met a happier people than the Germans. And Hitler is one of the greatest men among the distinctly great men that I have ever encountered. It was impossible not to be inspired by the infectiously cheerful atmosphere. Confidence throughout Germany replaced brooding, and the young opera singer signed up to 3 different National Socialist organizations. A student at the High School for Music, Elizabeth joined the National Socialist Students League. She was hardly alone, as about half of the university students did so. The young student was afterwards elected to a position of party leadership. When later joining the Deutsche Oper, she was noticed and mentored by both Marie Wagen and her pianist husband, Michael Reischussen. Both luminaries were also ardent supporters of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. Theater artists were not overrepresented in the National Socialist Party, nor was there any requirement for artists to apply for either party membership or party endorsement. Any artist's apolitical stance was understood and respected by the National Socialist German Workers' Party. However, those who did endorse the NSDAP were appreciated. 1 in 5 theatrical world and various artists were members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. In her case, her loyalty to the ideals of National Socialism was very much respected, not only in the party itself, but throughout Germany. The young singer successfully applied also for a membership of the National Socialist People's Welfare Organization. Is this any different in the capitalist West, where ruling parties are always delighted when a celebrity offers their endorsement? In order to get a work permit and to eat following the defeat of Germany, the performer was required by the invaders to recant her deeply held convictions. Elizabeth always refused their threats and their blackmail. Internationally celebrated opera singer was never forgiven by her nation's conquerors, and nor did she wish to be forgiven. To her death in 2006, Elizabeth Schwarzkopf was to stand by her beliefs. Palace journalists had the gall to criticize her for her enthusiastic support for all things National Socialist. These despicable and cowardly scribblers had the chutzpah to wax indignant over her refusal to collaborate, genuflect, and toe the Allied line. Little is known of Elizabeth's private life throughout those years of triumph and then adversity and to defeat. This most gifted of sopranos did contract tuberculosis during the years of war. When convalescing in Germany's Tatra Mountains, Elizabeth's constant companion was a high-ranking SS officer whose identity has never been ascertained. He was said to be Dr. Hugo Jury, Galitier of Lower Austria. Apart from being a Waffen-SS, General Dr. Jury was also a highly skilled medical doctor specializing in tuberculosis. Elizabeth died on August 3, 2006, at the age of 90, at her home in Schruns, Austria. Regarded by many in the world of classical music as possibly the best soprano ever, she had by then been awarded a Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. However, Elizabeth Schwarzkopf was never in doubt as to the value of her membership that her heart truly belonged to. This pocket biography is one of 25 vignettes celebrating the best of Europeans through the period of the Rock. It is in Mike Walsh's book, Heroes of the Reich. Now, while I get a drink of water, I'm going to play the YouTube tune that Mike has attached. Hopefully it'll be loud enough. To hear this great soprano who loved Hitler and his political party. The abrupt ending. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'd now like to read, get into action or digger for truth. His was posted on March 4, Dream On. Some may argue that it is futile or time-wasting to talk in terms of when we beat these tyrants, or when we've taken back power, as if we are to learn to walk first before we can run. I agree that our energy really ought to be protected at gaining recruits to the truth, capital T, getting as much new blood, winning our majority, but I also think it is important we have definitive goals. In any project or area of achievement, we need something of aspiration to focus on. Otherwise, what's the point in fighting at all? Just to avoid pain and suffering? Our focus goal really needs to be specific. We need to implant this image, dream, and intent in our software. And it is imperative that it is accurate, detailed, specific. What exactly is this new reality we want? Just as an architect with a team of engineers would have precise, detailed technical sketches to the finest detail, so we are to fantasize and visualize the exact world we want to live in and win, bold letters. We need to start planning this in our collective psyche ingrained into collective software. This is definitely not time wasting. Every single invention is born from a creative thought. I would say it's imagination that is the birthplace of all creation. I-E-Y-E, Manjin. First, the image fantasy in one mind's eye, then intent, driven energy, capitalization of resources and talent, then eventual reality. But it is important to couple this with a realistic time frame. Dreaming about some fantasy reality, some far-off time in the future, will not pull things off. So, in light of this, here is one of my, capital T, truth dreams, and one I can't seem nor want to let go of. In caps, global never again museums. Every single capital city is to have mega museums dedicated to the truth. Each museum is to be called the Never Again Museum. Accompanying these mega museums, there are to be proportionally sized museums for each town. Again, dedicated to the propagation and education of pure, unadulterated truth. Oh, how I fantasize about these. To finally get the truth out on full display at a physical level, not just cyber level. Of course. My cat, by the way, likes what Type Digger for Truth is saying. He's meowing, let me know it. Of course, by this stage, the truth will be out anyway. On TV, all cinemas, theaters, academia, advertising, etc. But one cannot beat the mesmerizing visual experience of walking through an organized and well-presented museum. But this time, it will be of our theme, pure, undiluted truth. Our truth museum spread out across the globe. I think it would be important to ensure all the capital T museums have a commonality in their comprehensive themes, but I don't think they should be cloned. Each nation and race has been affected by this pernicious, destructive tribe, collective jewelry, in their own unique way. So, it will be important to allow each culture to express their own history and experiences as suitable. Here is an outline I have dreamt up. Number one, capacity. The Mega T Museums will be three times the size of Texas Big Bowl. Next, architectural aesthetics. The most beautiful, traditionally built construction with quaint, even quirky architecture. Built by the finest tradesmen as national community projects. In the way people in previous generations passionately built holy shrines and places of worship, the finest of the finest, built for permanence. Next, layout internal aesthetics. Rooms, 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 and more rooms with a maze of interconnecting corridors. Spaces of all sizes and shapes, huge arena-type conference halls with stained glass atriums emanating colored natural light, and small, delicate, almost private rooms for moments of reflection. Huge paintings dedicated to historical figures who have stood for the truth. Hitler, Henry Ford, etc. Next, atmospherics. Lighting, water themes, appropriate tasteful music, ideal temperature. Next, specific areas. Tea video rooms, theaters for tea plays, cinemas, cafes selling only ethical, healthy, natural foods, kindergarten and children's play area, spiritual centers with meditation, silence rooms, guided tours, washrooms with full amenities, interactive group sessions, extensive quality libraries and resource centers the size of the London British Museum, in-house academia centers where regular tuitional tea courses can be attended, first aid rooms, probably where many people end up having fainted when they realize the harsh truth. Next, themes of the truth. The Holocaust, and labeled as such in huge notice, the biggest fraud of the 20th century. The Russian Revolution, showing the 66 million deaths by Bolshevik Jews. Likewise, the French Revolution. Poisons used against us. Chemtrails, industrial, foods, etc. The media role. The main players. The various slave trades. White slave trade. The truth behind the black slave trade. Dedication area, theme for all the innocent animals who have unnecessarily suffered under this Judaic beast. Dedication areas, themes for all the prominent historical activists fighting this beast. The 109 expulsions and why.
Here is Majestic Ape, a performer at Comet Ping Pong.
And you all are very grateful that you are below a Subway sandwich shop.
Yes!
And Jerry is known to hang out down here. He likes world sounds. To mamas.
And little boys.
And children.
I think that was his manager.
No.
Investigate Pizzagate.